Hi, everyone. Welcome to Kremlin File. Today, we've got a very special guest, Oleksandra Matvichuk. Oleksandra is a Ukrainian human rights lawyer and a civil society leader. She heads a nonprofit organization, the Center for Civil Liberties, and she's an active campaigner for democratic reforms in Ukraine and also in the OSCE region. In fact, she's been awarded the Democracy Defender Award of the OSCE in 2016. She's also heading up investigations on Russia's war crimes.
Matvichuk was also nominated to the UN Committee Against Torture, and she made history as Ukraine's first female candidate for the UN treaty body.
Yeah, today it's really, really an honor for us to have Oleksandra here in Kremlin File. So without any further ado, let's welcome Oleksandra to the pod. Hello, Oleksandra. How are you holding up? How are you coping with everything?
Well, I follow my basic feeling that I have not asked myself how I feel, because we now work with a human pain. It's very intense work for all four months of Russian large-scale invasion. It's very difficult from emotional and from physical sides, and that's why I always answer that I'm more or less okay.
More or less okay. Okay. Well, we're sending you huge hugs. Okay, from our side, and for your work and for everything else. Oleksandra, you were visiting different European cities and areas, and also the United States as well. No, how do you perceive the support from these areas, from the different people that you've met for Ukraine?
I will start with that point that we felt this support the first months of Russian invasion when I was myself in Kyiv. For that time, our city was circled by Russian troops, and we didn't know what will be with us next morning. And that weeks and that days, we felt support of ordinary people, because a lot of people wrote to my Twitter, wrote to our social network or organizational profile with words of support from different countries. And this is matter, because when you are fighting, it's very important to know that you are not alone. Then when I first time left Kyiv in the end of May of this year, I saw this on my own eyes. For example, when I have a time to walk in on the street in Washington, I saw the Ukrainian flags in windows of some flats or some gardens, and it was a visible sign. Okay, maybe it's not Ukrainians, but to support Ukrainians who now fighting for democracy, you haven't be Ukrainian. You have to be a human being.
Yeah, and you know, also just recently, there's also another sign, I think. Okay, I mean, I'm here in Europe. There was another sign of concrete support. And so congratulations for Ukrainians and for the state itself on the candidate status, okay, for the EU. I know there's a lot of work that still needs to be done, but this is an incredible, show of support also for Ukraine as a state, no? And we're proud. We're actually quite lucky that Ukraine is going to be, okay, in the EU when, there are different reforms that need to be made and so on and so forth. But I'm thinking of all the people who had started the campaign from 2004, wanting to be in the EU, and then in 2014 with the Maidan, with Euromaidan, and now with the war. So congratulations, okay, to you all, okay, to you all. Let's get down to some other questions as well. And I was reading something that Benediktova had said on Ukrainian television. And she said, war crimes, okay, are our trouble. Every day we have from 200 to 300 of them. We have a duty. When there is a crime, we have to start an investigation. And she just said this, I think, the other day on television. So I wanted to ask you, we wanted to know for our listeners and for our people who are watching, how difficult has it been, Alexandra, to collect, let's say, the evidence and record all of these crimes, you know, in Ukraine, on the territory, but also if you're able to get any information also from the territories that are temporarily under Russian occupation?
It's a difficult work because, first of all, we faced with enormous amount of crimes. Russian troops used war crimes as a method of warfare. That's why they deliberately destroy civil objects and attack civilian population. And it's very difficult to proper document all kind of evidence of each crime. And we have this ambitious goal to fulfill because we collect these materials for future justice. Also, it's difficult because we are in a hot stage of war. So we have no luxury to examine the past. We always have to be ready to immediately react if something happened and to send or our mobile groups or try to find another way to look for information which we needed. Yeah. And the third problem, like a barrier and obstacle, is that the part of Ukrainian territory under Russian occupation. Before this large-scale invasion, we have 7% of territory under occupation. It was Crimea and part of the Donbas, and now more than 20. And yes, we have information what's going on in the occupied territories, but still it's only a top of iceberg. A lot of information are hidden, and a lot of crimes are hidden for current moment. So we have now situation when we have not only to think in how an appropriate way to document all atrocities which Russians committed in Ukraine, but what will be the instrument who will deliver justice for dozens of thousands of victims of war crimes. And this is the main question, because you mentioned Euromaidan before. During Revolution of Dignity, I was coordinator of civil initiative who provide legal aid for the all prosecutor protesters around the country. Mm. At the end of 3 months, since we have a database with 16,000 requests for help. It was different kind of request. Some people called us because they were scary, and we have a group of psychologists who work with that people. But still, it was a database which shows that it was a systematic and large-scale attack of authoritarian regime to peaceful protests. And after 8 years, we have a very modest result of justice. So I don't want to repeat this experience, and that's why we have even large task, not only to document all these crimes, but to invent the effective mechanism who will deliver justice.
Okay. Actually, I have just to follow up on this as well, Alexandra, how many groups are working together to gather the information? Like how many people are on the ground? How do you communicate or how do you gather the evidence itself?
I can explain it on example even of our single organization. We work on two directions. First, we restore our volunteer initiative Euromaidan SOS and united several hundreds of ordinary people across the country, and they gathered the testimonies of the victims and witnesses of war crimes. We used very simple methodology because ordinary people have no knowledge of international humanitarian law and have no special preparation. And that's why it's 5 or 6 questions. So it's not even testimonies. It's a screening of diseases. But because of involving of ordinary people, we are able to quickly gather a lot of such videos and testimonies. And we had a proper understanding of the main plot of this human story and the contact. And if after analysis of these videos, we will think that it will be useful for legal purpose, for example, for international criminal court or for national investigation or for universal jurisdiction for some country, we can contact these people again and make the more detailed interview. So it's first approach, it's approach of so-called numbers. And second approach is approach quality. We united with several dozens of organizations, mostly regional, who work in their region for years and have very good understanding of people and region as well, and trust among them. And we have an ambitious goal to restore in chronological order everything which Russian troops committed on the territory in Ukraine, starting from 24 of February in the smallest village in each oblast. We spent a lot of time to develop this single methodology, to teach our documentators, to look at the quality of their work. We use different methods like mobile groups or SINT, work with verification on Berkeley protocol, like Bellingcat do, gathering testimonies, photo, video, documents. And for current moment, our documentary machine is moving, and now we have in our single joint database more than 10,000 episodes.
Wow.
And unfortunately, we will have more because, as I told, a lot of things is still hidden from eyes, especially in occupied territories. And also the war is going on, and every day the Russians committed a new act of violence.
Okay. Thank you.
That's horrific. It's beyond. Alexandra, so we have seen Russia not only targeting civilians intentionally, because part of their war is to target civilians, humanitarian corridors, and basically go to house to house and murder families. For decades, the Russian regime, especially with Putin and his hardliners, they've discussed erasing Ukrainian heritage. And that's not the first time we've seen this, in the past century. We saw what Stalin did to Ukrainians. We know the sentiment inside of Russia against Ukrainians. And now we are seeing specifically Russia targeting cultural centers, stealing artifacts, burning down churches, burning Ukrainian books, forcing teachers in Russian-occupied territories to teach to speak Russian and to have the children speak Russian, and. Wouldn't that constitute a genocide? Because there's still an argument, that this is just a war. When Russia is showing that they want to destroy the culture and to erase Ukraine off, the map as how it exists, wouldn't that constitute a genocide?
I totally believe and can confirm that this war has a genocidal character. And this genocidal intent is very visible in Russian propaganda. When top political and top military officials of Russia increase in hate, they named all Ukrainians like Nazis. They tell that Ukraine as a nation have no right to exist, that Ukrainian language does not exist, that Ukrainian culture does not exist. And then this hate is resulted in a violence and the enormous pain which Ukrainian civilians feel for current moment because of action of Russian troops. Also, we can see this genocidal intent in the colonization and Russification process, which have already started in EU occupied territory after 24 February. Look what's going on in Kherson region. and precisely in Mariupol, which is most bright example because of well-known and publicity of this case. They deported Ukrainians to Russia. Like they prohibited pupils to study in school on Ukrainian language. They burned Ukrainian history book. So they try to erase Ukrainian identity. And this is also a tool how to provide genocide when you want some concrete group totally or partially destroyed. Like the whole this policy can be named with a phrase which the former president of Russia, Medvedev, told, "I want all Ukrainians vanish." But we don't want to vanish. We are human beings. Yeah. We want to live, and that's why we are fighting. But what is the problem? Now we have the discussion whether we can judicial ground to call this genocide or not. But for me, as for people who now in a war, it's very obvious that we have to start another discussion. How we can stop it? Because if we will not stop it, and this hate will increase in, and this is very obvious that during the battle, the hate become more and more intense. So we can reach the dangerous point when it will be no doubt is it genocide or not. Like, we can remember Rwanda case, where it was also a lot of alarming sign to international community, but international community closed their eyes and do nothing, and this opened the path to massacre.
Yeah, even more so. Even more so. It's true. Yeah. It's true. It's true.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi: People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Alexander, you were saying that, you know, a lot of the Russians, the Russian leaders, people that we hear on television, so on and so forth, who say that Ukraine should not exist, okay, as a nation, which in itself is absolutely insane, okay, to say. They are carrying out, let's say, passportization and all of these different things. Deportations. Can you give us a little bit for our people who are watching, who are not, haven't been following this? Could you just give us a little more detail on that and on the cities exactly of, let's say, Mariupol, what is happening there, and in Kherson?
Russia officially states that they have deported up to 2 million people, among them more than 300,000 of children. These people have no option and no to choose, because why it's forcible deportation? They have either left in dangerous zone, because Russians don't provide permission to them to safely evacuate to Ukrainian-controlled part of territory, or to go to territory of Russia and have a chance to survive. For sure, a majority of people want to survive, and that's why it's forcible deportation. They have no right to choose. Then they appeared on territory of Russia with this huge amount of people, and a lot of them without documents, without money, without understanding of their rights, what they can do in order to leave this territory. People were for weeks or even for months in bomb shelters without food, water, electricity, medical care. A lot of people in a huge trauma because they lost their children or their parents or their members of family or were witness of horrible atrocities. So such kind of people in such mood appeared on Russian territory. And now Russia started to transfer these people into different regions of Russia. Mm-hmm. And how it's going on? When these people appeared on territory of Russia, they was told that you have to be in such place because the train will move you to another region. And when they ask for what concrete region, they got answer that region which will have free place for you. And such people find themselves, for example, in Vladivostok or other far from oblasts of Russia, which become for them even more difficult than to evacuate and to leave the territory. And this policy provide opportunity for Russians to stop Ukrainian in their territory because it's very difficult for them to leave this territory. Once again, when you speak about people in trauma, you have to have even an energy to ask for help. A lot of people now lack this energy. And especially when we speak about more than 300,000 children, who even our Russian human rights defenders have no access to them and no understanding where they are and what they are children, whether Russians speak about children with parents or about children without parents or about children whose parents were killed by Russians and then deported. So we have no understanding, but what is clear that if these children will remain in territory of Russia, they will transfer them from Ukrainian children and enroll their identity to Russian people because they will provide their Russian passport, they will provide them Russian education. So it's also like a very cruel policy how Russia tried to solve their demographic problems, especially in a very depressive region of Russia, with using people which they try to erode identity. And it has to be provide a proper analysis by international community as well.
Yeah, it's like they're replacing also, are they bringing Russians into Ukraine as well? It's almost like it's like they're erasing, no? The whole, what you were saying before, Alexandra, like they're erasing or trying to erase, you know, all of Ukrainian identity. This is the biggest example. When you take away a whole group, you know, of people and children that are Ukrainian, and they're trying to erase their whole life. I mean, it's something that is unbelievably. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's unimaginable.
And on the Russian side, I mean, Russia for decades, their birth rate has been going down. Their, you know, population has been going down. So basically, this is a very sick, cruel way of kind of increasing their population by stealing people off of their land. Yep. Alexandra, we've heard a lot about filtration camps, which to me personally remind me of Soviet gulags. You know, recently there was a report of torture, murder being committed in these filtration camps. And this is where people, Ukrainians, are being kidnapped and then put through these filtration camps before they move on to Russia. And some of them are on Russian territory, some of them on Russian-occupied territory. Can you discuss these filtration camps? And also, can you let our audience know about, you know, the concentration camp in Crimea? Because, you know, Europe ignored a concentration camp since 2015, I believe, in Crimea that Russia had set up after they annexed and occupied it.
We spoke with people who passed this filtration procedure and this filtration camps. So a lot of things, it's still hidden from us because we have no opportunity to speak with people who didn't pass this filtration procedure or filtration camps. But what we know for current moment, that from April this year, Russians provide obligatory procedure for all people who try to leave the dangerous zone in order to survive, to pass through so-called filtration procedure. And this filtration camps is infrastructure of this procedure. As I understood, initial goals was to provide distinction between civilians and combatants, but it's very quickly turned into the very inhumiliating and cruel procedure with a lot of human rights violation, like privacy, like health, other kind of freedom. And also, there is no guarantee for any people how they have to behave in order to be guaranteed not to be beaten or not to be intimidated during this procedure. We spoke with people who were beaten during this filtration procedure. We spoke with people who were witness of cruel treatment or killing of other people or heard about such cases. And the problem for us as for human rights defender is that when you are in war and you are in fire and a lot of things is going on and you try not only to document, you try to help people to survive. We every day receive hundreds requests of help. And that's why for us it's very difficult to concentrate on some concrete topic and to examine everything what's going on. That's why I have like some very general description of this filtration procedure, but it's obvious crimes against humanity, and the whole this procedure is crimes against humanity. What I can say about concentration camp, I will use example of Donbas, because such concentration camps were very widely established in occupied part by Russian of Lugansk and Donetsk region in 2014-2015. Because when Russian pro-Russian paramilitary groups with support of Russia occupied this part of territory, they have another task to save this control. And in order to save this control, they have correctly created a whole network of secret illegal place of detention of people. And they started a practice of kidnapping, of torturing, of killing and raping civilians who are not loyal to this occupation regime. And the main group of risk were journalists, volunteers, religious leaders, representatives of local authorities. So any people who have a trust or can provide even non-violence resistant to occupation regime. And the most bright example, like a symbol of horror, which Russians organized in this territory, which transferred to a gray zone where the law is not exist at all, it's isolation, concentration camp isolation. There is a brilliant book of Donetsk journalist Stanislav Asiev, who worked during all these years in Donetsk, and he wrote articles for Radio Liberty, not use his real name, but he was arrested because of his journalist work and put in this concentration camp isolation. He spent in this concentration camp 2 years, and when he was exchanged, he wrote a book about whole atrocities. What does it mean for human being to be in such camp? It's very important book because it clearly show for the world what's going on now in Kherson, Zaporizhia, or Kharkiv region in the territories which occupied by Russian troops. I know that Garvard will publish in English this book this autumn, and I strongly recommend it to read it.
Yeah. Definitely. When the book comes out in English, please send us the link. I'll also keep an eye.
There's one book that I did get through, Oleksandr, which was Azayev's In Isolation, which is all about the camps, you know, in Luhansk and Donetsk. So I'm sorry, I cut out because I'm having internet problems, issues once again. As I said, I've got the slowest connection in the world. All right, shall we move on to the legal issues?
Yeah, go ahead. You have the next question.
Okay, it's mine. Okay. Oleksandr, we wanted to know a bit about the different courts that have been activated and who are looking into bringing justice for the war crimes themselves. I had heard about the ICC, but also in my reading, I discovered that there's the prosecutor's office and also, you know, in Bucha, there's another court as well. Can you explain?
And just on my end, Merrick Garland, who's the Attorney General for the Department of Justice, just came back from Ukraine and met with Venediktova specifically over war crimes.
Over this, okay.
So we now have to speak about what will be the mechanism or instrument of justice, because yes, we have the International Commission on Inquiry, which was established by UN Council of Human Rights, but or Moscow Mechanism of OSCE or another special rapporteurs of different international organizations or conventional or monitoring bodies. But this all instrument are not bring perpetrators to justice. They can make reports, they can make recommendations, they can make conclusions, but still we need an instrument who can put war perpetrators to jail. Let me frame it very directly, because this is important, not only reports, recommendation or assessment what's going on. So now we have only two such instruments. The first instrument is International Criminal Court. And the prosecutor of ICC announced the full investigation on the 2nd of March this year. They sent the group of prosecutors to work on the ground. I had meetings with them, and we cooperate. And even before this large-scale invasion, we had experience of cooperation with International Criminal Court. It's important mechanism, but still it's not an answer to question who will provide justice. Why? Because International Criminal Court will select only several cases. I will remind you that only our joint initiative recorded more than 10,000 of episodes. So, okay.
Oh my God.
If International Criminal Court select only several cases to investigate, the question still remains on the table. Who will provide justice for all other thousands and thousands of victims, which will not be selected by International Criminal Court? And the answer is national system of Ukraine. And here we can return to the word of our general prosecutor, Irina Venediktova. She announced recently that Office of General Prosecutor opened more than 17,000 criminal procedures. Once again, 17,000. Wow. You can imagine that it's enormous amount. Even the Scotland Yard, even the best office prosecutor in the world are not capable to investigate such huge amount of crimes. Now we have a situation when each investigator have to parallel investigate more than 200 criminal procedures. Just to be more understandable, imagine that you have in one time to write 200 books, 200 different books. So, okay, maybe it's very very direct analogy, because some cases have links and the same perpetrators, but still it's very difficult to investigate parallel 200 criminal precision, because it means that you have no time to investigate properly even one criminal precision, which you have such high task. That's why the question is how to increase the potential of a national system to investigate and then to deliver this justice, because the same problem we will see in Ukrainian court, which will be overloaded with criminal cases. I just left under the frame that we have the best office of general prosecutor in the world. We still was in process of reforming our judicial system, our system of law enforcement bodies, and they even sometimes lack a knowledge of international humanitarian law to do it in a proper way. So we promote as a human rights defender the idea of creation of international hybrid tribunal, which can cover the whole type of international crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide and aggression. And this is very important. I think it's important not only for Ukraine and for dozens, thousands of victims, but for the whole world. I spoke in Oslo Freedom Forum about atrocities which Russian troops committed. And when I going to the hall, the girl from Libya approached me, and she hugged me, and she was crying, and I also was crying, because she told, I know what are you saying about, because Russian troops committed the same crimes in my native country. They destroyed schools as well, and they raped women as well. And I was surprised because, sorry, I don't know a lot of details about Libya, and I asked Russian troops, and she answered Wagner groups. It's very famous so-called private company, but it's private company which is directed by Putin and affiliated with the Russian state. So we have to break the circle of impunity, not only for Ukrainians, but for Libyan people, for Syrian people, from people in Georgia, because if we will not be able to stop Russian troops in Ukraine, they will go further. They remain unpunished for decades, and they really believe that they can do whatever they wanted. We must hold these criminals accountable.
I absolutely agree. And to add to, you know, the Wagner mercenaries, which are under direct orders of Russia's defense ministry, the UN recently, a few years ago, came out with a report of the same exact thing, them walking through Central African villages, committing atrocities, raping women, massacring people. So, I mean, wherever Russian troops are, it's safe to say that they're committing war crimes.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Alexander, final question. We're going into the summer where we know many people are now going to go on vacation, you know, and media is not really the coverage of Ukraine. The media is waning. What does Ukraine need to win this war? And how can we make sure that Ukraine is not forgotten, that it's still in the news, that people still understand the importance, you know, of supporting Ukraine, and that Ukrainians are fighting not only for themselves, but for European and United States security?
Yeah.
Like, how do we make sure, you know, that people still keep it? Because my biggest fear prior to this was, you know, that, yes, the media will cover it for a bit and then eventually disappear, but the atrocities are becoming even worse day by day, and yet now you see maybe a 30-second coverage every other day of Ukraine. So what can we do to make sure that people, you know, are thinking about Ukraine, understand Ukraine, and what does Ukraine need from us, from Europe, from
it's
US?
A very brilliant question, because frankly speaking, I'm afraid if Russians did what they did in Bucha during that time when the whole world was watching what's going on in Ukraine, you can only imagine what they can possibly do if the world will not be watching what's going on in Ukraine. So I think that we have to remind to ourselves that this war has not only territorial dimension and like ethnicity dimension, because Russians try to kill the Ukrainian people only because we are Ukrainian, but also democratic dimension. What do I mean? This war started not in 2022. This war started in 2014 after a collapse of Ukrainian authoritarian regime, when Ukraine obtained a chance to provide a quick democratic transformation. And 8 years ago, in order to stop us on this way, Russia started occupation of Crimea and hybrid war in the Donbas. So now we are fighting for our democratic choice. And when we succeed, it will have a huge impact to the whole region and to the democratic future of Russia itself. Mm-hmm. If we'll not be able to stop Putin in Ukraine, he will go further, because it's not the war between two countries. It's the war between two systems, system of authoritarianism and system of democracy. And this, Ukraine now only a far front of the battle between these two systems. And that's why I understand that it's very difficult to stress attention only to Ukrainian event. And it's possible when you are in Vienna or in Berlin or in Washington or in Geneva to switch off the news. But now millions and millions of people couldn't switch off the news because we're on the streets. And we live in very interconnected world. Once again, Putin announced that he has historical mission to increase the territory of Russia. So it's very understandable that who will be the next target in European Union. So now we are in a situation of war, when we as a people couldn't rely upon on rule of law mechanism, because the whole UN system couldn't stop Putin's atrocity. And we very clearly see that the whole UN system lays in ruins, like Ukrainian Mariupol. But what still work? Human solidarity still work. If we couldn't temporarily rely upon on law, we can rely upon on ordinary people. And we feel the support of ordinary people who demand for their own government to support Ukraine, to provide long-range distance weapon to Ukraine, to impose their effective economical sanctions against Putin regime, to help Ukrainian refugees in their country. So ordinary human solidarity, it's been more than the whole international architecture of peace and security. I believe in people, and I totally believe that massive mobilization of ordinary people in different countries can change this situation for better. And our task, now I try to respond to your question, is to provide opportunity for ordinary people, how they can join. Now we will thinking about different informational and other kind of campaign, which can involve different people throughout the world.
Okay. Alexandra, are there Are there, I don't know, some associations, like where do you recommend that we can send some of our listeners? Because I have friends even here in Italy, they don't know, okay, exactly where to go. I usually direct them to the Ukrainian government's website because it is, you know, official. But are there certain groups or that you know of that need help and where we can direct some of that, you know, some
it
of those people there?
It depends what people are wanting to do. If they want to donate, it's better not to donate to international organization like UN or International Committee of Red Cross.
Yeah, no.
Because we will obtain this assistance after 2 or 3 years. They're very slow and very bureaucratic. Yeah. And speed is very essential in a war, because when you need water, you need water now, not after 3 months when you proceed all tenders, procedures, and all bureaucratic agreements. You can die without water. So speed, it's very important. That's why if it's about donation, there are a lot of reliable Ukrainian fund, like Save Lives, Poverniz Zhivim, or for example, American organization Razum. So it's very easy to Google and to find the trustful Ukrainian funds. If you want to do some in legal purpose, you can contact with us, with Euromaidan SOS. We have Facebook page, we have Twitter page. You can find myself in Twitter. And we now try to establish more comprehensive cooperation with lawyers in different countries and bar associations in order to find a proper solution, what we can do in situation when the law not work at all. And if you want to volunteering, also there are a lot of different initiatives which emerged when international organizations evacuated from Ukraine. For example, we have Ukrainian volunteer groups, and they have also their website, their Facebook, and you can join to their work. So I totally believe that if ordinary people will help Ukraine to resist, we can stop this war fast and not to turn to very long war, which will provide exhausting not only for Ukrainian people, but bad impact to the world itself.
Yeah.
And just to add one more thing, you know, everybody is a social media user. If you see Russian disinformation, just take the simple step to say this is disinformation, because Russia's fighting this war on the ground in Ukraine and fighting this war in the social media, you know, space. And God knows I constantly, you know, see their disinformation and the fear-mongering, you know, operations that they're trying. Even with Lithuania, simple, you know, Lithuania enforcing partial, you know, ban on sanctioned goods, which was like minimal, had nothing to do with a blockade.
Yeah.
And I mean, the whole day from morning to night, I just saw, you know, oh my God, World War III. Well, World War III. Yeah. I mean, what is the point of sanctions if you're not going to enforce them? You know?
Yeah.
So the samples, a simple step just to, you know, make sure to mark it, because even now with trolls, obviously, but like, you know, influential people, the Russian ambassador, ambassadors, and just anyone, you know, that you see spreading disinformation.
Yeah. Okay. We would need to thank you, Oleksandra, for the time that you were able to give us from your busy, okay, from your work, from your busy work. And we stand in solidarity every single day with Ukraine and with Ukrainians.
Героям слава. Thank you very much for solidarity and for this discussion.
No, it's our honor.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming on. And anything you need us to help you with, please, you know, we're here. And we will be happy to do whatever we can on our part.
I'm very grateful. And even through this Zoom, feel the warmth of your heart. Like now it's very matter, because when, once again, when you have no other effective instrument, you can rely upon only on people. So we are really grateful. Thank you.
Hey, everybody. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to subscribe. And please visit our website, KremlinFile.com. This is a Bunker Crew Media production, hosted by Olga Lautman and me, Monique Camara, with executive producers Marley Clements, Jack Bryan, Grant DeSimone, Ben Brett, and Jordy Mycelis of Midas Media, with associate producers Ruby Frankel and Sarah Metz. Theme music by Oreste Camarra. Sound editing and mixing by Joy Ellett. Subscribe to Kremlin File wherever you listen to podcasts.